are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
Wednesday, September 26, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks, and I'm Michael Wednesday. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Murtaza Hussain, reporter and columnist for The Intercept. We're talking about the Trump administration war on the ICC, counting the costs, the fallout of the Syria war, and Trump at the UN, and a global update. Fresh, right before the show, new, horrifying, just, I don't know the word, grotesque accusations against Judge Kavanaugh and his whole, not his whole, but many parts of his cohort in high school and at Yale. Trump is attacking the accusers. And Arizona and Republicans in the Judiciary Committee pick a prosecutor to question Dr. Ford. And four people are now corroborating her assault claims. Avenatti says this is the real deal with Julia Swetnick. And she certainly has a very real things to lose if she wasn't being anything other than fully truthful. Bill Cosby is going to jail. His spokesperson has some pretty incredible things to say about him and Judge Kavanaugh. Trump threatening to cut off aid to loyal countries. Mike Pence knew in advance about Michael Flynn's phone calls to Kislyak. Fernando Haddad growing in the polls as looks like Brazil, under the leadership of the Workers' Party, might fight off a fascist challenge. Tom Steyer to spend millions backing Andrew Gillum in Florida. And the GOP is zeroing in on abortion to turn out its troops for the midterm elections. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Adam Rainstopper with the new, we're doing a trial run for new openings.
Yeah, we've had a few submitted. Thanks, Adam Rainstopper, Jimmy Reefercake's new collaboration
Jimmy
partner.
Jimmy Reefercake's new collaboration partner.
We're coming up real quick with that one. It's weird because we're so used to the pressure drop.
It is. It's very hard to get your sort of like to do your shout outs over a new beat.
Yeah, like, because it's not like Pressure Drop is a very serious song, but you could do like serious headlines over it and it didn't feel out of place.
No, it didn't feel out of place. That felt a little...
It's hard to talk about the Kavanaugh stuff.
Right. I'm talking about just this horrifying, disgusting stuff, and I feel like I should be like an extra, like, I don't know, like we should be at some like ska party in the mid-90s or something.
But thanks, Adam. That was
thank you, Adam.
Nice.
No, that was good. That's a strong contender.
Tight,
strong contender. We've made the point, and of course, this probably already wouldn't apply because now there's already so many other stories coming out here, that if Judge Kavanaugh had said, look, there was an incident, stuff happened when I was younger, I've learned, I've grown, we wouldn't be talking about this. We would be talking about actually all of the horrifically destructive things that he wants to do to the court. Republicans are still fixated on this high school doesn't matter talking point, which also contradicts. And almost, it's a very interesting defense because it basically takes as a fact essentially, that the guy they're defending is lying completely today. Here's Brian Kilmeade with, you know, he's just outraged, the poor guy.
So that's what, and I was at back to school night last night for my 10th and 12th grader. And little did I know, I was just trying to see if they have blown any shot at any success in life in 10th and 12th grade. Because that's what I'm getting from this whole process. Well, when in doubt, go back to high school and college, even if you're in your 50s.
But there are serious allegations that have been leveled against Mr. Kavanaugh by Dr. Christine Ford. They are serious.
They're serious, but they're unproven. And for people to go in life and say, okay, let's go back to high school to stop you from moving forward. I mean, I heard of your transcript mattering in ninth grade for college, but I didn't know your ninth and tenth grade actions could really reflect on what happens in Supreme Court.
Well, I welcome Brian Kilmeade to a broader struggle for restorative justice, for a more compassionate society, one that does not try juveniles as adults, one society that actually looks at as many prisoners as possible as people who could be rehabilitated in society, and a less destructive culture. I welcome you to that, Brian, to that battle, Brian. I doubt I'll see you there, though. But they're pushing the high school talking point. This morning, Michael Avenatti, who did tease this, and let me just stipulate, the reason I stipulate this, I understand he's done some things with immigration law that are questionable, and I just want to say that because obviously, you know, Stephen Ronald Reagan is a very important person to this show and a friend and a very serious immigration attorney, and it's important to note where Avenatti's maybe been remiss.
And we also don't support his 2020 presidential.
We're not big fans, but I think he's certainly mostly been right with his aggressive approach to Michael Cohen and to Trump and to this whole cabal. And he's now brought forward a woman named Julia Swetnick. And I'm going to just read a bit, actually, from her sworn declaration. My name is Julia Swetnick. I'm a resident of Washington, D.C. I fully understand the seriousness of the statements contained within this declaration. I have personal knowledge of and information stated hereon, and if called to testify to the same, I would do so. I would and could do so. I'm a graduate of Gathersburg High School in Gathersburg, Maryland. I presently hold the following active clearances associated with working in the federal government: Federal Trust, U.S. Department of Treasury, U.S. Mint, MSM, Internal Revenue Service. In other words, I have things to lose. I have also held the following inactive clearances: Secret U.S. Department of State, U.S. Department of Justice and Public Trust, U.S. Department of Homeland Security, Customs and Border Protection. And she goes on to list a range of government employments. And now she's talking about when she first met Mark Kavanaugh in the early 80s. And also Mark Judge. I would describe them as joined at the hip, and I consistently saw them together in many social settings, she said. Point number 7. Following the first introduction, I attended well over 10 parties in Washington, D.C. area during the years of 1981 to 1983. Where Mark Judge and Brett Kavanaugh were present. These parties were a common occurrence in the area and occurred nearly every weekend during the school year. On numerous occasions at these parties, I witnessed Mark Judge and Brett Kavanaugh drink excessively and engage in highly inappropriate conduct, including being overly aggressive with girls and not taking no for an answer. This conduct, including the fondling and grabbing of girls without their consent. I observed Brett Kavanaugh drink excessively at many of these parties and engage in abusive and physically aggressive behavior towards girls, including pressing girls against him without their consent, grinding against girls, attempting to remove shirts on girls and to expose their private parts. I likewise observed him being verbally abusive towards girls by making crude sexual comments to them that were designed to demean and humiliate them. Yeah, let's skip to 11, though you should read the whole affidavit, but this is where it gets... I mean, this is certainly, you know, I don't know what statute of limitations on these things are, but these are the most serious charges. During the years 1981 to 1982, I was aware of efforts by Mark Judge and Brett Kavanaugh and others to spike the punch at house parties. I attended with drugs and or grain alcohol so as to cause girls to lose their inhibitions and their ability to say no. This caused me to make an effort to purposely avoid the punch at these parties. I witnessed efforts by Mark Judge and Brett Kavanaugh and others to target particular girls so they could take advantage of them. It was usually a girl that was especially vulnerable because she was alone at the party or shy. I also witnessed efforts by Mark Judge and Brett Kavanaugh and others to cause girls to become inebriated and disoriented so they could be then be gang raped in a side room or bedroom by a train of quote-unquote train of numerous boys. I have a firm recollection of seeing boys lined outside of rooms at many of these parties waiting for their quote-unquote turn with a girl inside the room. These boys included Mark Judge and Brett Kavanaugh. So these are coming out. In approximately 1982, I became a victim of one of these gangs, a gang or train rapes, where Mark Judge and Brett Kavanaugh were present. Shortly after the incident, I shared what had transpired with at least two other people. During the incident, I was incapacitated without any consent and unable to fight off the boys raping me. I believe I was drugged using Quaaludes or something similar in what I was drinking. I am aware of the other witnesses that can attest to the truthfulness of each of these statements above. So they're scheduled to hold hearings tomorrow.
We're going to start streaming.
We're
going to
start
early.
Streaming a rally around
9:50.
Okay, 9:50. We're going to stream them live. And I mean, you know, obviously now we're in a completely, like, we're not talking about the conversation is already on a completely different ground than, you know, this sort of disingenuous nonsense about high school, into allegations that don't get more serious by very credible accusers. And people need to, I mean, take this in and of itself, and then I think also realize that the Republican Party is doubling down entirely so far on defending this.
Yeah, don't put anything past them.
And I would not put anything past them. And I think actually for some of these people, it's going to become a point of principle in a broader misogyny and a broader politics, which is horrifying and grotesque and dangerous and, you know, obviously just a rot at the core of American life. So we will be here with that tomorrow and talk about it more on the second half of the show. But for now, we're going to take a brief break and we'll be right back with Murtaza Hussein from The Intercept. Back to the Majority Report. Joining us now is Murtaza Hussein. He's a columnist and journalist for The Intercept. Murtaza, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Always good to be speaking with you. Let's start with Donald Trump at the United Nations. Actually, Matt, I should have said before, I don't know if we still have the laughter handy. It's always fun to play that clip. Let's just play this clip really of Trump talking about how great the last year has been, or his entire administration has been, and the response from the General Assembly. And maybe you could sort of just touch on Trump at UN Week to get us started.
Today I stand before the United Nations General Assembly to share the extraordinary progress we've made. In less than 2 years, my administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country. America's so true. Didn't expect that reaction, but that's okay.
Murtaza. What's it been like? I guess he's trying to be diplomatic there.
Well, you know, he's doing the boasting he does in his domestic speeches, except that, you know, the UN audience is not primed for that, and they're not the most appropriate audience. They don't care what you claim to have accomplished in the last 2 years of your administration, or whether it's better than Obama or Clinton or Roosevelt or whoever you're trying to compare yourself to. It's an absurd statement, and it predictably, in my view, got a laugh. I'm glad he's forced to acknowledge it, and I'm glad that people are forced to acknowledge that he's making the administration into a literal laughingstock internationally.
Into a literal, I mean, that is really funny to reflect on, like, how many, like, that Republican talking point of, like, and Trump all the time with Obama, they're laughing at us, and it's like, literally, the world just laughed.
You know, like, my capacity for shock has been so degraded over the last few years, or what's really possible. You know, the Overton windows move so much, but still, like, to be giving the UNGA speech, the American president, and literally the entire world is gathering and laughing at you, and laughing to the point where you're forced to acknowledge it, it's a cinematic moment. It's a moment of real national decline, punctuated on the world stage.
Let's talk about, you have a piece called The U.S. Goes to War Against the ICC to Cover Up Alleged War Crimes in Afghanistan. I talked about this actually briefly on the Michael Brooks show last week. First of all, let's do a little bit of a history if you can, because the United States, this is definitely an area, obviously, that sort of hostility from the United States, the International Criminal Court, is not new to Trump. It has a history here. So maybe we could talk about that, and then we'll get to the question of war crimes in Afghanistan.
You know, the United States is one of the few countries in the world which has not signed the Rome Statute, which would make it party to the ICC. And, you know, there's been different messaging from different administrations. Clinton and Obama sort of flirted with the idea of potentially taking some role in the ICC, short of being a member. Bush was more overtly hostile. But fundamentally, the U.S. has never wanted to be party to any international organization which it does not have decisive control over. Mm-hmm. So they want a privileged spot in the organization, or they don't want to be part of it. That's generally been the rule. And the ICC has not really afforded them such a position. And if they were to become party to it, they would legitimate potential investigations into war crimes carried out by American officials in various theaters around the world. And, you know, the U.S. is, you know, more, how can I put it, they're more likely to be active militarily in different countries around the world than other parties are. And they do not want the level of oversight or scrutiny that the ICC would put on those activities, and nor do they want, you know, if you take the case of Afghanistan, particularly what they're so exercised about is report, ICC prosecutor's report. Prosecutor's report is into acts of torture and rape and killing that were carried out by U.S. military and CIA in Afghanistan. And it very specifically points out that their responsibility for these acts went very high up the chain of command. They were not just their rogue acts of some bad apples. And there's absolutely no way that the U.S. would ever allow a situation where their top officials are being indicted by the ICC and they're legitimating that process by recognizing the ICC. So, you know, it's the optics on going to war against the International Criminal Court have never been good, but this administration does not care about optics at all, and they're going full throttle in attempt in their hostility and making vows to destroy the organization completely.
What are the we'll get to the actions they're taking to undermine the ICC, but first of all, what are these crimes in Afghanistan, and how do they go up the chain of command?
So in this report deals not just with American actions, but also Taliban actions and actions of the Afghan government, and it deals very specifically with years, 2003, 2004, the early years of the occupation of the country. And they deal specifically with detention policy and people who were taken into detention by the Americans and by their contractors, killed, subject to rape, subject to beatings, various other mistreatment. The report does not go into specifics, naming names of officers involved or naming victims, but it's a high-level look at the crimes that they've documented. And they documented being systemic. And they make specific note that these actions came about as a result of policies which were developed by the government. They weren't just contraventions of American policy. They were the product of specific policies that U.S. officials had implemented with regard to detainees. And, you know, this is not surprising because the CIA did its own, or sorry, the Senate Intelligence Committee did its own investigation into CIA practices, and it very much found that U.S. officials were responsible for very egregious acts of abuse against detainees. So the ICC report is very general, but the U.S. is trying to withdraw any sort of cooperation with the organization now to make sure that we don't get any of the specifics, because the specifics, based on what we know so far, would not be pretty.
And how does this fit into the broader, like, what's incredible? I mean, there's so much happening in the world today, right? Like, obviously, we're focusing on Brett Kavanaugh, and we're, you know, just dealing with all of the crises and systems that were already breaking that led us to Trump and global Trumpism. And we're also dealing with the fact that, you know, and maybe you could speak to this briefly, you know, the United States is now engaged in, you know, heavy military activities in at least seven different countries, you know, across Middle East, Africa, and Afghanistan just continues, right? We go from the invasion by the Bush administration, then throwing it on the back burner so that they could invade Iraq. Then Obama's sort of, we're going to pledge more troops, but also sort of preset a drawdown. And now, you know, Trump, who occasionally sort of makes some isolationist noises, essentially just sort of doubling up. And, you know, it seems to me the only real shift is even a further unshackling and lack of concern for civilian casualties with aerial assaults. And then, of course, the whole, you know, dysfunctional dynamic with Pakistan, Indian and Iranian and Chinese sort of poking around. And this is all on the back burner, but we still have this incredibly important, incredibly high human toll global war that doesn't, I mean, it doesn't, I don't even, I mean, what is your anticipation about that? Is this just now what it is? We just have this ongoing war and occupation of Afghanistan? I mean, what's the kind of movement?
I think that we're headed very clearly towards the U.S. order in Afghanistan collapsing. The Afghan government that it's propped up after the invasion has not proven it's able to govern. It's been riven with corruption. It's not been able to exert its authority over vast swaths of the country. And now it's not just Pakistan, but it's China and Russia, which are also supporting the Taliban, and Iran as well, who are also supporting the Taliban. Not because they love the Taliban in every case, but because no one wants to tolerate an American-aligned presence in Central Asia. The government, there's been recent New York Times reporting that the U.S. has been underreporting Afghan government casualties because it's very clear what's going on here. They're losing so many conscripts to Taliban attacks. They're losing the war. And, you know, Americans don't pay attention to what's going on in Afghanistan very often, but what you see over the last few years is a very clear shift in the balance of power. And you also have Afghan elections coming up soon. And these elections could trigger a new civil war in the country because there are huge regional divisions that are about to come into very stark relief when this election happens. And it's not at all clear that Afghanistan can stay together as a unified country. You have a very, very grim situation shaping up. And the only thing that could maybe change it in America's favor is if they sent 100,000 troops back into Afghanistan. That's never going to happen. The era of a huge, wide-scale occupation of the country is long past. I don't think it's even good for what I don't see what interest the Americans would have in doing that. And secondly, it would just forestall the inevitable problems that are coming down the road anyway. I think that you're heading for a Saigon 1975 situation.
Yeah.
In the next couple of years.
Right. Yeah. How did Iran have a rapprochement with the Taliban? They were fierce enemies.
You know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend sometimes. Mm-hmm. That's, in this case, the bigger threat to Iran is America. The Taliban that had terrible relations with Iran, but they were never going to invade Iran, or, you know, they don't have that ability to threaten Iran's core interests. And the thing is, the Taliban has become much more pragmatic as an organization over the last 10, 15 years. So they're willing to have relations with Iran, or have relations with China, have relations with Russia, in the purpose of achieving their immediate term goal, which is returning to power in the country and ejecting the Americans or any other Western power, at least in the immediate term. And probably after that happens, they would be open to having some relationship with the Americans based on their own statements, in the sense of not creating another pretext for an invasion of the country.
What is, I mean, let's then pivot to another, part of the reason that's so horrifying with Afghanistan on the back burner, the sort of AFPAC story, is because we have, you know, the U.S., Saudi, UAE, just mass murder, criminal enterprise inflicted on Yemen, happily, you know, supported by the Obama administration, accelerated by the Trump administration, one of the greatest crimes on the planet today, with, you know, Raytheon weapons killing children. And then we have Syria. I want to talk about the substance of Syria, but I also feel like, you know, I'm not going to get into specific incidents, but this just keeps sort of flaring up on social media and everything else. And to me, I mean, I've said a million times what my basic analysis of Syria is, which seems to piss everybody off. And maybe I'll do it again in a minute. But my kind of question for you is, how disturbing is it that some people seem to, they're not even talking about Syria as Syria. Syria is just a proxy for proving some type of bona fides in like social media arguments here, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I hope that this debate is not still going on in the same way. I try to ignore it.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, it's important to understand the history of this particular country, which has a very particular history. It's not just another third world country, you know, as though they're all the same and there's all one paint by numbers approach to the whole world that makes sense. It has a very distinct history with French colonialism and the deliberate fomentation of ethnic and sectarian differences, very brutal military dictatorship, which came about as a result of that. And then later on, the current civil war and the influence of foreign powers from Saudi Arabia and Turkey to Iran and Russia, you know, I really encourage people to understand the history of the country and then make a judgment. Don't just assume that this falls into some amorphous sort of framework of from the Cold War, which no longer exists, to be honest.
Where are we in terms of the state of play now? It seems to me that the sort of, and my basic perspective, I'll just outline just in, you know, 20 seconds, and, you know, I think we're generally on the same page, but mine has been that this is a multi-sector sort of proxy war. You have the Russians, the Iranians propping the Assad regime. The Assad regime has made some very smart political plays, and I understand why some Syrians, relative to what the opposition has turned into, would, you know, feel safer in some respects with Assad. At the same time, it's indisputable, and anybody who says otherwise is responsible for, you know, conservatively hundreds of thousands of death, torture, all sorts of horrific humanitarian crimes. And then on the other side, You know, you have the United States and its Gulf backers, you know, supporting Salafist groups. You had you reported also on the Saudi instruction to light Damascus up. So, you know, U.S. weapons and Gulf money going to really ruthless organizations who I think in some cases have almost like religious genocidal intentions. And then, of course, there was, you know, the air war on ISIS, where we killed a significant amount of civilians as well, with maybe degrading ISIS to some extent, but not sort of dealing with the dynamics behind what created ISIS. I mean, I guess before I get to my second question, what I mean, is that sort of, do you buy that that's the kind of general dynamic here?
Yeah, I think that's a good articulation. The thing people need to understand is that multiple things can be going on at the same time.
Right.
You can have a revolution, you can have a proxy war, you can have a civil war. There can be more than two parties in a war. And
right.
There were a whole galaxy of parties, factions in the Syrian war, and they continue to be. So, you know, those things are not all mutually exclusionary. And
right.
There doesn't have to be a zero-sum debate on what's going on. There are many things going on. I think that in the early years of the uprising, 2011 onwards, there were a really inspiring generation of people who tried to shift, you know, change extremely brutal system. Like the fact that they're quote-unquote secular, you know, a lot of bad people are secular. In the United States, there are
right.
a lot of horrible monsters who are secular. That's not
right.
a get-out-of-jail-free card. And in fact, they're not even secular per se. They're just very good at manipulating ethnic divisions in their favor.
Right.
And those people who challenged that, they were extremely brutally treated. And now, even just today, we're getting, you know, confirmation of people who disappeared, that they were actually tortured in jail. Very progressive and democratic people who were, you know, horribly treated by a terrible government. And then later, Syrian society, you know, when some people say revolution, we tend to romanticize the word revolution because we associate it with certain positive historical experiences, and sometimes they are positive. But a lot of times, as Franz Fanon even said, you know, a revolution doesn't come about because people plan to happen. They just can't take it anymore. They can't take the way society is. Society just collapses.
Right.
He said, you know, people can no longer breathe, and that's what happens. And people just couldn't breathe anymore. And I think that when I look at it fundamentally, who's responsible for destroying society? It's the people who are in power. They suffocated society and then it collapsed, and these terrible monsters came out of it, like the Salafists and just criminals and things like that. And now you have a very society where the social fabric has been torn to shreds, and you know all that you have between chaos and you know the established order is the terrible government that you had at the beginning, which is going to govern even more brutally now because of what's happened in the last 6-7 years. And yeah, I think that there's a few areas outside government control which are not exemplars of democracy. There's just people doing the best they can in a terrible situation.
Right. And I think obviously, I mean, I've said a lot, of course, I think it's important not to romanticize either. But of course, if there's any faction or place that I'm going to have a certain higher degree of sympathy for politically and otherwise, it's obviously the Kurdish controlled areas, you know, on a number of levels. And not to, you know, they're obviously nobody is perfect. But I think if you're looking for any area of, you know, potential kinship lift, kinship with from a sort of global left internationalist perspective, it would be there. Do you think going back in the timeline, in 2013, I think the former South African president Thabo Mbeki gave an interview with Mike Hanna on Al Jazeera, and he said, and it was a sort of the conversation of should justice trump peace, and he was articulating a perspective which, you know, he has, I think, a very valid argument on, but also a problematic policy history, arguably. He probably could have been, you know, certainly stronger with Zimbabwe as an example when he was president of South Africa. But at the same time, he also has a perspective of, and first of which, obviously, the massive double standards of places like the United States, who have their own, you know, support for brutal and bloody regimes, plus their own, you know, massive death counts and everything else. But his point being that when he was transition, when he was negotiating with and part of the sort of key African National Congress teams that ended apartheid, which of course, you know, in the 1980s, 70s and so on, you know, the apartheid regime, that was one of the worst, you know, most cruel, most murderous, most barbarous regimes in the world. But he made the point that he did not want any of the people that he was negotiating with sort of carted off before an international criminal court, even though they had, you know, literally murdered his colleagues and made him a second class citizen. You know, he needed them to negotiate. Was there a time in Syria where it wasn't, you know, to coddle the Assad regime or in any way to undercut the real organic parts? Because certainly in 2011, the first uprisings, like people say, like, oh, that was a CIA, whatever. I mean, I'm so, you know, first of all, it's not, it is not documented, to say the least. And also, it's, you know, incredibly undermining of people's, you know, especially at that point, just think about very basic legitimate complaints about things like food prices, to say that, you know, people weren't actually angry at what was a very brutal autocratic and actually under the sun Assad and increasingly sort of open to kind of neoliberal regime. Was there a time when a sort of smart diplomacy that didn't go in the direction of, if, you know, he has to go, but we're not really going to do anything to have him go. And then what we will do is the CIA and the Gulf will do their usual thing of letting weapons flow around to, you know, Salafists and criminals. And then, you know, the Iranians and the Russians will engage in their own, you know, proxy imperial schemes. Was a diplomacy process ever really possible here?
You know, if you study the history of the Syrian Baathists,
yeah,
and the way they've governed and the ideology, or the, I say, post-ideological character that they've had in the last several decades, I think that there's no way that they ever would have negotiated. Not any way that, in the sense that they would actually give people what they want, which is, you know, sharing power or reducing their power, mm-hmm. or even putting a new leader or making a new political dynamic in the country. They're completely, they could have negotiated any time between. The war could have ended any time between now and 2011. The one thing you could have done is, okay, Assad's going to resign, we're going to have elections. Okay, then the conflict is, you can even maneuver your way into a privileged position in that new political order. But no, it was a very zero-sum attitude from day one. They did things to buy some time or to manipulate public opinion. But I don't think that they ever would have negotiated because, you know, we think a lot of fanaticism as, you know, religious fanaticism. But there's also the fanaticism of just power,
right.
Fanaticism of just arrogance and greed and all these things like that as well. And I think that this government, if you study its history, it has perfectly emblematized that. It's, you know, it's a republic. What kind of republic is passed from father to son?
Right.
This is a monarchical practice.
Right.
These are people who were, they said very clearly when the slogan was that we govern Assad or we burn the country. And they actually, from 2011 onwards, they governed in that way. They said, okay, if you don't want Assad, we'll burn down wherever you live.
Right.
And they did that. So I think that, you know, it's horrible what happened, and that there were things which could have been done differently. And I think that after 2013, you know, it was not in people's interest just to continue the war and feed it to no end and just destroy the country. But I don't think that they ever would have, if things had been approached differently, they would have negotiated. You know, it's hard to remember now, but the neighboring countries around Syria had good relations with Syria. Turkey had very good relations with Syria. The Saudis had good relations with Syria. And when the first uprisings happened, they were defended them. They said, you know, he's a reformer, let's give him some time. Let's try to talk them to end the assault on Homs, that don't send tanks into Homs. But they refused. They just did it because that's how they're used to governing. So, you know, I just think that most likely counterfactuals are hard, but I don't think so.
Right. What happens now? Final question, in terms of, you know, you have a new piece on sort of people accounting for the dead, which is depressing and horrifying. And then in terms of, you know, you're just seeing a double down on a sort of, you know, a victorious, brutal regime.
You know, after a war happens, and South Africa is a very good example you brought up, you know, terrible things, crimes are committed, mistakes are committed. And then, you know, what's next? How do you move forward? Like, human history is built on terrible conflict and the bones of previous people who've been exterminated. The way, only way you can move forward in a constructive way is to account for those crimes and to express contrition or to express some sort of change in a positive direction that lets people heal and move on. Yeah. What the government in Syria is doing is not doing that at all. It's doing, it's behaving, it's saying, okay, you know, your wife or husband disappeared in 2012. They're protesting. You know, you never heard from them again. They would, you know, that they were killed in prison or they're tortured in prison. Here's the, we're not even going to tell you, if you come to the government office and you ask about them, oh, you know, they had a heart attack or they died of natural causes at 24 in a prison. They are basically telling people, hey, look, you know, you can't do anything about what happened. We won. Your loved one who died, it doesn't matter. There's not going to be any accounting. There's not going to be any apology. There's not going to be any truth and reconciliation process. We're in charge now. No one's going to help you. And that's how things are going to be. And is that really a recipe for, it's not a recipe for justice, first of all. And I don't think in the long term it's a recipe for stability either. People, I've been to the camps in Turkey, full of Syrians who have been expelled. These people want to go back home and they're very angry. They had their family members raped or killed. You're just planting the seeds for a new round of hatred and revenge. And I feel that a smarter government, a less fanatic government, would not behave in that way.
Right. Well, Murtaza Hussein, he is a columnist for The Intercept and a reporter. I always appreciate your work, and thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. All right, everybody, we're going to go to the fun half. We've got a lot to get to, and we will take it from there. Last night on the Michael Brooks Show, I talked to Alberto Almeida, who is a Brazilian political scientist and pollster. We talked about the elections.
He's Brazil Nate Silver.
He's the Brazil Nate Silver, although I think with a more
except
charming
act.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, very a lot cooler.
Brazil, the way, I think that is characteristic of the Brazilian way of speaking English, and it's great. I like it.
No, it was great. It was a lot of fun. We crunched the, we actually got into some data and some regional dynamics, and he's predicting good things in that election, which obviously first and foremost for Brazil, but it does have some implications on halting this global march of fascism, and so on. Then Matt Taibbi came in. We had a great time with Matt Taibbi. Taibbi's looks like he's becoming a new, he's probably going to be a new regular presence on TMBS this Sunday. An illicit history of the Maple Leaf. What's Canadian politics really about? And Woke Bros, of course, with Waz, TMBS, patreon.com/TMBS. Check out Jamie, Sean, and the Antifada. Really interesting episode on debunking, or not debunking, but guiding the Illuminati story into a story about capital. It's really good sort of...
meeting people where they are.
Meeting people where they are. I love that. Matt.
Yeah, Literary Hangover. Check out the Scarlet Scarlet Letter episode if you haven't checked out that yet. And I should have the second installment of my reading series available for patrons for the book Hope Leslie by Catherine Maria Sedgwick. Either tonight or tomorrow, I'm hoping. So, patreon.com/literary hangover.
Awesome. All right. I think we will. I will dispense with the fish and Grateful Dead jokes, Brendan. I think they were somewhat funny while they lasted, and we're going to need to come up with a new angle. We're joking about the fact that you don't have a Patreon to flog yet.
I know. Someone's got to hold it down for the Majority Report. we're getting the war chest ready for Politicon in L.A. That's my job.
Oh, yeah. That's going to be fun. All right.
Do we know when we have any announcements regarding that, or...
I think that's up to Sam's discretion.
Okay, well.
Oh, I'm holding everybody in in suspense. Do you see?
All right, we'll see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Who sent us this?
Alpha males are back, 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 back. boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danner theme song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break for people.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, folks. Reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych. Fuck them.
Homo says what?
What?
Homo says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black. African. And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on!
Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are back. Africans are black.
Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.